Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus on Albany. My guest today is Steve Greenfield, and Steve is going to be talking about the consolidation of power in New York State of the two political parties. So, Steve, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
Good. So what's been going on that people should know?
Well, you know, the thing I want to talk about today is the new proposal that's here in New York by the Public Financing Commission. And the, in fact, it's not a proposal at this point, since the Democrats in both houses of our legislature have declined to reconvene by the end of the year in order to block the Public Financing Commission's proposals. They do become law on January 1st. This is, you know, a pretty big problem in New York is that most people in this state are unaware that our state legislature really doesn't do a whole lot in terms of the laws and practices under which the state of New York operates. We have these things called authorities, like the Port Authority and the, you know, international,
right.
the Industrial Development Authority. We have 12 or so sort of bureaucracies that were created and funded by the legislature. They make all the decisions about what happens in the particular fields that they cover. And the legislature's job is to get together once a year and just decide what amount of money each of these authorities get to do what they do. They rarely do anything to influence what happens. And of course, the people on the authorities are not elected. They're not accountable to the public any way. They're appointed. And it's the same thing with this Public Financing Commission, which is, you know, despite its name, its real function is to figure out what goes on with elections. How many signatures do you need to get on a ballot? How much money? What's the maximum campaign donation you're allowed to take? What portion of your campaign donations can be matched by public financing? You know, it's called the Public Financing Commission, but it's really our electoral management system that determines, you know, who can get on the ballot, how much money they can raise, and, you know, how that is all going to operate. And like the authorities, they have the ability to make law. Whatever they say is law, unless the legislature convenes to specifically field a proposal to reject their proposal and passes that in both houses and has the governor to sign it. And, of course, the people who are on the Public Finance Commission are there by appointments of the leaders of the chambers of the legislature, and some of them are there by appointment by the governor, just like the other authorities. So they're there to represent the interests of the people who appointed them, not the general population, you know. And that's something I think New Yorkers are going to have to consider, is learn a little bit about how laws are actually made in this state and how most of them are made by appointed people that are accountable only to the people who appointed them and will be making laws and regulations based on what serves the interest of the people who appointed them. And that's pretty much kept invisible to the general public. You know, you don't exactly see what's happening, what just happened last week with the Public Finance Commission here in New York, and the fact that the legislature has declined to convene to reject their recommendation. On any news station, it's not like there's anybody telling you about this. They get to operate with complete impunity because the media keeps them shielded from public awareness. Now, what's happening in the immediate sense right now is that they have decided that they are just completely changing the way that candidates can get on the ballot, and they're doing so in a way that makes it possible for the two major false parties in this state, the ones that always run the candidates from one of the two major parties, and I'm talking about the Conservative Party, which only runs Republicans, just gives them an extra line, and the Working Families Party, which only runs Democrats and gives them an extra line. Those are the parties that manage to always achieve the thresholds that they need in gubernatorial elections to remain on the ballot under the new proposal, which raises it from 50,000 to 130,000. And the reason that that's significant is because since the candidates for the Republican, excuse me, I'm got a little congestion. The candidates for governor for the Conservative Party and the Working Families Party are always the candidate on the Republican and Democratic Party lines. And so Republicans and Democrats vote for those candidates on those other two party lines to keep those party lines open without it affecting, you know, the vote for those two candidates, because you're voting for a person, not for a party. So if it's the same name on you know, two different party lines, they'll just, you know, cross party lines to keep those lines open, and that's what ends up happening. Whereas truly independent parties like the Greens or the Libertarians that don't run existing candidates from existing major parties have to actually get to that 50,000 threshold to maintain party status by attracting enough voters that don't want to vote for either of the major party candidates, that specifically don't want those candidates to be the next governor and are trying to help establish competitive small parties that can rise up and hopefully confront the complete control of the two-party system. And so what they decided to do right now is to raise that threshold from 50,000 to 130,000, because they know that the two, what I call the leech lines, the lines that run second lines for the Democrats and Republicans, always easily exceed 130,000. But the independent parties don't really get to that total. The Green Party, no one's ever done it. The Green Party's done it once, which was back in 2014. And that was really an aberration, because that was a year that a lot of progressive Democrats in New York State were very, very angry at Andrew Cuomo for a variety of reasons. Statements he made that he was going to break the teachers union, a conflict he had with the Working Families Party over Zephyr Teachout, and some things that created a lot of ire in the progressive Democrat community and caused a few extra votes to be directed in Howie Hawkins' direction to register that protest. But of course, last year that vote total that he got dropped down to 108,000, which doesn't really scrape close to the 130,000. The Libertarians just got 90,000 votes. It's the first time in their history that they've ever exceeded 50,000 votes. So they're on the ballot for the very first time in history. But that'll, of course, end, you know, in 2022 in the next gubernatorial election, if this stands, because they're not going to get 130,000 votes. And so what ends up happening as a result of these decisions – oh, and there's another thing. There's a second level that they added, as if that weren't bad enough. When you're not on the ballot as a balloted party because you didn't make the gubernatorial threshold, but you want to try to get on the ballot anyway, we have signature thresholds. There are 3,000 for congressional districts, I believe 5,000 for state Senate districts, and 15,000 for any statewide ballot, like the governor, the attorney general, or president, anything that's a full statewide position. And this new system triples those totals. So you'll now need to get 45,000 signatures to run for governor just to try to get the 130,000 votes that would allow you to reestablish a ballot line once you've lost it. And that, of course, is an absolutely impossible threshold to reach, because that's always factored by the number of signatures that aren't valid and end up getting, you know, anybody who's done petitioning to get on a ballot as an independent candidate, and I certainly have done that, you know, and even as a party candidate, you will lose, you know, 30 to 40% of your signatures, because it turns out upon examination when people challenge your petition that the signature doesn't match an address, or the person wasn't registered to vote, or whoever. You know, you're just out there collecting signatures. You need to get, since you get 45,000 signatures and be sure you're going to stay on the ballot, you really need to get 75,000 signatures. And so, you know, this is just an impossible bar. This is clearly a naked power grab. This is just a way to wipe independent third parties and leave this false impression we have in New York with our strange fusion balloting system that allows other parties to run major party candidates on their lines, that this fake second party system that we have here is going to actually be reinforced and further entrenched and serve the two major parties as they always have, which is why they exist. And any independent party that's seeking to challenge power, or even, as we sometimes talk about, to just get enough votes to point to the major parties towards some policies that they may have to adopt if they want to keep attracting votes, right? That's always been a critical function of minor parties, is to be able to get enough votes to show the even if you never win, that you show the major parties, for example, like we did here in New Paltz back in 2004 when we held the same-sex weddings, was a message that was sent that, you know, kind of directed the hand of the Democrats to make same-sex marriage legal in our state, because the public response and support to these, at that time, illegal same-sex weddings in New Paltz that were conducted by Green Party elected officials was so overwhelming and so overwhelmingly positive that that ended up generating the acceptance of same-sex marriage in major party institutions in this country. So it's also suppressing not just the access to the ballot, of course, but all the functions that that access to the ballot generates that actually benefits all of society and not specifically members of or candidates of the minor parties that are getting on the ballot and running. You know, look back at the 1930s Social Security, minimum wage, National Labor Relations Act to protect union organizing. All of these things came from the Socialist Party platforms. Franklin Roosevelt adopted them. They are now, you know, the accepted contemporary social contract of the entire United States. Even Republicans won't, you know, wipe away Social Security, you know, minimum wage entirely. You know, we've all learned, we come to accept these things, but we only accept them because the growing vote totals that were accruing to the Socialist Party made one of our major parties think about that would be a good way to get more votes and win elections. So this is truly a way to not specifically just suppress minor parties, but suppress the contribution that you know, that outside the mainstream candidates and thinkers and ideological thinkers contribute to the evolution of democracy, the evolution of the American social contract. All of this is being shut down here in New York. This is, of course, on the heels of a few years ago when supposedly the most liberal state in America, California, the largest state in America, changed its general election rules in a way that only permits major party candidates to be on general election ballots, because they've decided to restrict their general elections to only the two top finishers from all parties in the primaries. And so they end up now in situations where there's sometimes two Democrats running against each other in the general election. But anybody from the Peace and Freedom Party or the Green Party or any other smaller party in California, they can run in their own party's primaries, but they'll never again be on a general election ballot to create that discussion and that ballot pressure to have new ideas advance into the general forum and electoral arena. So what we're seeing now is a trend on the part of the major parties. You know, and it's interesting because, you know, the liberals will always hold substantial discussions, and these are legitimate discussions, right, about vote suppression, right, that the Republican Party implements that supposedly helps Republicans win and prevents Democrats from winning. And those things that are done, like vote caging and things that people, you know, those are real things, right? The Republican Party does do those things. But how do you distinguish that from these things in California and New York that the Democrats are doing, which are also voter suppression? You're literally telling people from now on that if you don't want to vote for either a Democrat or a Republican, that, you know, you just have to use a write-in vote, which is, of course, ridiculous, because then a candidate's not campaigning. The media is not covering that candidate. That candidate's ideas are not being distributed to the general population. You know, so yeah, a handful of protest voters might write somebody in, but the idea that we're a democratic country where anybody can run for office, what we're really leaning towards and heading into right now, with, you know, New York being the second largest blue state, California being the largest, and so by population, you're talking about, you know 30% of states of the American population, or more, 40% that's under the control of Democratic Party institutions, are now going to be you know, completely electorally suppressed and limited to only major party candidates on election day. You know, so both parties are doing it. They're just doing it in different ways, right? So they're both doing it to their left. They're both doing it in the same direction. the Republicans are trying to shut down victories by Democrats, and the Democrats are trying to shut down having to be accountable to any pressure from the left. You know, this, it's they're both working in the same direction, and they're both doing it for the same reason, right? Because they're doing it on behalf of the corporations and people of very high net worth that actually control the campaign donor system, the privately financed donation system. And they don't want anybody intruding upon that process. They're just being – they're pulling the veil off what their interest has been all along and just saying, look, we're just wiping third parties away. We're just wiping them off the electoral map. They're not going to be allowed to run anymore. And, you know, sure, on paper, it looks like, well, you can run. But, yeah, no, if I have to get 80,000 signatures, no, I can't run. How much time and money do you have to be all over New York State with the number of people that it would take in a period of 4 weeks? Because that's the other thing. The petitioning has to be done within a four-week window in order to be valid. You don't get to have, you know, a whole year to get to 80,000 signatures. So you need a few hundred people all over the state working all day long, knocking on doors, standing in shopping malls, hoping to find somebody who will say yes when you just say to them, this doesn't mean you have to vote for me. It just means you support my ability to get on the ballot, right? And you have to have hundreds of people all over the state to try to make 80,000 signatures within a four-week window. And then what happens is, you know, the major party candidates immediately challenge your petitions, and they're going to challenge them signature by signature. They're going to challenge all – they're going to go through all 80,000 signatures because they can pay a couple of million dollars to hire a law firm to do that for them. And you certainly can't contest it. You know, all of us in minor parties have experienced having to go to the Board of Elections and sit through challenges to our petitions. But we don't have the resources that they have to counteract the challenges to those petitions because we can't pay $2 million for an election law firm to handle it for us. And so this is truly the ending of ballot access to minor parties. That's it. That's what this is in a nutshell.
Plus the fact that the primary process is moved up and people have to get, I'm sorry, the ballot, the petition process has moved up and people have to get signatures when it's really cold out, which inhibits people from giving 100% of themselves to getting signatures, right?
Right. And, of course, major party candidates don't even have this problem with having to be outdoors in the cold because when major party candidates are holding petition drives, they get a few hundred Democrats to hold house parties, and they cater them with food. Nobody's standing out in the cold. People come to your house, and they eat a meal, and they sign your clipboard. You know, the homeowner is there with a clipboard saying, here's the candidates, and so all the Democrats that they are hoping to be on the ballot, from governor down to your local state legislators, you know, they're all on a slate, on a single petition sheet. And the people that come to your party, they sit there, you know, enjoying conversation and food, and they sign the petition. Whereas, you know, again, just because of that there's, you know, whatever, 7 million Democrats in this state and 4 million Republicans, so they can do that. But when you have, 30,000 Greens dispersed across the entire United States, across the entire state of New York, there's no way you're going to be holding petition signing house parties. Here in where I am in Ulster County in a rural area, I sometimes have to, you know, take a half an hour drive just to get one signature, you know, because somebody's up on the side of a mountain, you know, and down a dirt road. And, you know, the state outside of the dense urban areas, the state is rural. You know, you have to drive. You're not, that person is not taking a 40-minute drive to come to your house party. It's not, you have to go to them. So the whole entire system is now being set up to cancel any genuine minor parties that are not running either the Democrat or the Republican for governor. And enabling their maintenance to be created by people crossing over specifically to maintain the ballot lines, having nothing to do with ideology or candidacies. You know, that's
Howie Hawkins was out in the forefront talking about, you know, climate change and the Green New Deal, and it was because of what he said that AOC picked up on a Green New Deal. Does that mean that the Green Party a run for governor is out of the question now, and all of these issues that Howie raised that were so important will be silenced?
Right. Well, of course, that's exactly what it's intended to do. Now, you know, for the time being, at the next election, the Green Party and the Libertarian Party are both still on the ballot, because back in 2018, when the old rules of needing to only get 50,000 votes were in effect, those two parties got more than 50,000 votes. So this would be basically aimed at removing minor parties from the ballot subsequent to the 2022 election. They can't, you know, take away existing ballot status. But yes, what's the function of trying to take away ballot status? Look at the sequence. I mean, I referenced Franklin Roosevelt and the Socialist Party back in the 1930s, but I appreciate that you brought it back to the here and now and what's happening right now. We all know that, you know, the term Green New Deal was brought into the entire national lexicon by Howie Hawkins when he ran for governor in 2014. It was his central to his platform. And, of course, you know, now a lot of people are talking about, you know, Andrew Cuomo helped pass a very important green energy bill last year here in New York, which is true, right? But it's because the Green New Deal has grown so much from 2014 to today. In 2016, Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate for president, picked that up and made it a national campaign issue. Right. And she went from 480,000 votes to 1.5 million votes in a single election, you know, because this resonated with people. People wanted to know about this. And yes, as a result of her getting 1.5 million votes, that caused some of the more progressive entering first year members of Congress, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, to adopt the phrase and make it a prominently featured thing that made it into a household term and something that millions of people now want to see the government actually do, right? But yes, if Howie Hawkins doesn't get on the green ballot in 2014 to run for governor in New York, and if subsequent to that, because she would now need 80,000 signatures to if Jill Stein isn't able to be a balloted candidate for president in New York State, then that never happens, right? Then the Green New Deal never gets mentioned. It's just, you know, life goes on with nobody being concerned about a specific large-scale program to transition to green energy and save us from the most devastating effects of climate change that are approaching us as we speak. People aren't even discussing whether climate change is, you know, an emergency status matter. It was only, you know, the existence of minor parties and the fact that they could get votes and be on the ballot and therefore be recognized in the media as existing, as pursuing votes on a particular platform that has allowed the general population to start thinking seriously for the first time since it was first brought to Congress's attention all the way back in 1980. That it's, you know, long past time for substantial intervention into climate change, and that we need substantial government policy to make that happen, because there are obviously market forces mitigate in favor of cheaper fuels, and we'll continue the combustion of fossil fuels. Yes, so that is exactly what the purpose of this suppression, voter suppression, on ideological grounds is based on. It's based on the preference for keeping these ideas from entering public discussion, right? And that's something we need to be frightened of. I want to be very blunt about this. As ordinary people, we need to be extremely frightened about what this process represents, right? Because we know that starting in 1977, every single penny of gross domestic product growth has gone just to the upper 10% income earners of our population. And most of that actually to the, not the 1%, but the 1/10 of 1% at the very top of the, you know, the very top of people who have, you know, net worths of $500 million and up were receiving almost all of a tripling of gross domestic product that happened in this country from 1977 to the present, with wages not only not keeping pace with that growth, but only keeping pace with inflation, So that now an ordinary person's purchasing power relative to the size of the market is one third what it was in 1977. And so, you know, that is, you know, the two things are closely tied together. When Congress passes a substantial corporate tax rate cut, and that doesn't translate into increasing demand for any corporation's products, right? The only way to increase demand for their products is to put money in the hands of consumers, not in the hands of producers. And so what everyone's been doing, and there has been some reporting in the news about this, what all the giant corporations have been doing with the couple of $1 trillion that the government, federal government, just gave to them as a gift, is not investing in expanding their production, right? They have no reason to expand production if there's no additional money in the hands of consumers. What they've been doing with that money is buying back their own stock that's out there on the stock market, so that they don't even have to have as much democracy at their stockholder meetings. Like, that was the closest thing to democracy in the private sector as one could get, which is that you could try, if you wanted to have a proxy war and struggle to get people who own stock to let you vote with their stock at quarterly shareholder meetings and annual shareholder meetings at major corporations. But now we're finding that the corporations themselves are all using that gift from Congress and from Trump to buy stock that's out there on the market from ordinary people that have them in their private portfolios. And so that the corporations themselves now own more than 50% of their own stock, which means their boards of directors can do whatever they want with corporate policy without anyone ever getting to vote on it, because the board of directors controls more than 50% of the voting stock. And so that's what's happening in the private sector, parallel to what's happening in the public sector, increasingly restricting access to democracy on the parts of anybody that doesn't want to be a member of two private organizations that have been given control of our election process by the government. It's really important to remember that last point. Political parties are not in the Constitution. Political parties are private membership organizations. You have to join them. So how did it ever become a thing in the first place that we have passed laws that specifically state which private organizations? We have privatized our elections. That's not recent. By allowing political parties, even though they're not in the Constitution, and by passing laws, you know, you walk into any New York State County Board of Elections and you see it's got one Republican commissioner and one Democrat commissioner. That's it. There's no third commissioner that represents the, you know, the 35% of New Yorkers that are not enrolled in either of those two parties. And so they have ballot access requirements. The state legislatures, which of course are made up entirely of Democrats and Republicans, then vote to establish ballot access procedures or empower a private commission to establish ballot access procedures. And it's only Democrats and Republicans. All the appointed people on the New York State Public Finance Commission are Democrats and Republicans, appointed by Democrats and Republicans. And so, you know, we have legalized in this country and in this state the power of two private membership organizations that are funded with billions of dollars of private donations a year, each of them, to control who can run for office in what our Constitution describes as a democracy that shouldn't have those kinds of barriers. But we do. And so, you know, the corporate agenda right now, after 42 years of slow and steady encroachment on both the net worth of our economy as well as how our political processes operate, with the super PACs and everything else that's been rolling in over time to eliminate even the pretense of limits on how much money people can spend on campaigns, and for challenging the ballots of other parties that are trying to enter the process. That we're really reaching the end game now. You know, we're reaching the end game of fascism as we speak. Individuals can no longer hold enough stock to influence the way a corporation will institute its own policies and practices by being able to vote at shareholder meetings. And at the same time, we in the public are no longer able to vote in a public and democratic way for the very government positions that could be the only counterbalance to unlimited corporate board power over our lives, over our economy, over our political systems. And so with this move for the elimination of third parties that's now happening here in New York and has already happened in California, we are really seeing the end game of this 40-year process of the consolidation of wealth, and along with that consolidation of wealth, spending it to purchase the consolidation of power over both the private and public sectors. As those people get elected, what do? Whenever a public service is needed, they contract it out to a private company, right? You need prisons built, that's going to be contracted out to a private company. You need them to operate, you know, all kinds of things are being privatized now. The charter school movement, right, to have public schools operated by investors with no school board, with no elected school board to oversee how the money's being spent and whether the education is really of a higher quality. This is just going on and on and on, is that the last revenue streams here are taxpayer revenue streams, right? The education budget, the military budget, everything, you know, roads, highways, water systems are being privatized and taken out of any kind of democratic oversight on the part of elected officials. And it's the elected officials themselves that are signing away that right to oversight. And why are they signing it away? Because they're Democrats and Republicans. because that's what they ran to do. That's what the campaign finance system has elected. The people who attract the biggest donations are the ones whose platforms suggest that they'll do the most for those donors. So that's where we are. And I have to tell you, Cynthia, we are extremely close to the end game as we speak. This has been a corrosive process happening with no public outcry except by cranks like you and me. The very outside party people, they're now have enough power consolidated that they can completely sideline us in the electoral arena. We'll still be allowed to make our cranky Facebook posts, right? But you know, what's that going to do to change anything? You know, nothing. That's going to do nothing at all, you know. So we're at the end game right now. And so people have to really register that in their minds and let it sort of build in their minds what it literally means when we've lost any ability to access the decision-making process of both the public and the private sectors. What is that? There's a word for that. There's a historic word for that, which has nothing to do with genocide and everything to do with the public-private governmental partnership, and it's called fascism. That's where we are. We are now finally arriving at the end game of this four-decade process Yep.
You see, you have really, really great identified the problem. Let's talk in another show on solutions, have the people to get involved, how they can have their voices heard. I think it's really important because what's going on is pretty frightening. So we'll talk
right
again at some future date on what people can do to counter all this stuff that's happening.
Right.
Okay, so you've been listening to Focus on Albany, and I'm Cynthia Pooley. You've been listening to Steve Greenfield. If you like this show, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, download on your smartphone, subscribe to iTunes. If you have a comment about the show, hashtag Focus on Albany. Steve, have a great, great weekend. Everybody, thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.